and over to you.
All right, thanks, Chris. Look, it's a pleasure to be here. I always say that the media in particular underappreciate the size and scale of the multinational segment in the Australian market. Our media and investment community have an obsession with all things listed and let everyone else slide below the radar. And I've been tracking this for a while, and as I'll show you a couple of slides, people forget and should understand the scale and size of the businesses that you're running, and in my view, as a nation, we should be tapping more into your expertise whilst you're here. I guess on that theme of foreign ownership of multinationals, the phone rang this morning at 7:20, the mobile woke me and my wife and our three-year-old who jumped in the bed in the middle of the night. Up, and it was Adam Spencer from ABC Sydney, wanted some comment about the fact that the legendary Australian brand, Victor Moa, had been sold off to an American conglomerate. So come on board and do the populist drum banging about, competing with Dick Smith about Australia losing all their brands. So 5 minutes after waking up there, I was talking to 200,000 Sydney-siders about quite a bit of the content that I'll show you today in this presentation. Firstly, just to prove that I'm a pretty unpopular guy, there's a few quotes of what some people have said about me. My personal favourite is Kerry Packer. Do you set out to be offensive or is it just natural? All I'd asked him was whether he'd lost money in Hoyts. And Alan Jones as well. People like Stephen Mayne don't deserve a place in society. And I had one from Maxmore Wilton 2 weeks ago at the Macquarie Airport's annual meeting where I asked him a question and he said, "You are significantly out of sync with informed opinion, Mr. Mayne." So I'm doing my best to ruffle a few feathers. There's a full list of my failed board tilts. I am Australia's most unsuccessful candidate. There's 29 public company boards I've run for. Some of those good results up in the 30s, 40s and 50s were back in 2000 before people realised what was going on. Where all the institutions just donkey voted down the page, assume because no one ever ran for boards. And basically I run for boards as a way of putting pressure on companies. So any company that was doing cash for comment with Alan Jones and John Laws, I would run for their board on a platform that they stopped. Sometimes they were straight populist tilts like David Jones in 2000. My platform was that all shareholders get the same 35% shopping discounts that the directors get. Things like that, just to highlight issues, because in America you can put up a shareholder resolution if you own $2,000 worth of shares. In Australia you need 100 signatures, so it's very difficult to get a resolution up. Yet to run for a board you only need one signature. So I run for boards as a way of putting pressure on companies, and it's also not bad direct marketing if you're running Crikey or Main Report, because they have to mention your URL in the distribution that goes out to all the shareholders. So when I ran for 8 boards in 9 weeks back in 2000 when I was almost broke, I actually did a direct mail campaign that hit 5 million households for free. So anyway, but mostly it's all about driving better governance. And there's a list of my other failures. I did manage to become president of my local chess club back in 1988. Got to the top of the Kinder in 2005, but only lasted a year at the Kinder. And everything else is a loss. I lost against Costello last year, got 2% of the vote in Higgins. But my wife got elected to the board of the RACV, Australia's richest mutual. So I got her to run with me in 2005 as my running mate. She beat me by 20%, so I couldn't even beat my wife. So I said to her, "Next year you run, and you know women do better than men in RACV elections." And she knocked off a bloke who'd been on the board for 29 years. So that's 80 grand a year she's getting, and she's subsidising the Main Report with her RACV board fees at the moment. Now I want to talk a bit about how Australia competes internationally. You know, it's terrific how we always finish top six in the Olympics and everyone thinks that's fantastic. But I track lists of these things and I can only come up with 81 Australian companies that are generating more than $200 million a year offshore, whether that's from from foreign-owned operations or from exports. And there's some best good performers I've listed there. I mean, the News Corp, CSL, our one success in the pharma space, ComputerShare, world's biggest computer registry company, Cochlear, you know, magnificent ear implant product, Worley Parsons, Westfield, great story, QBE. There's a few more that have risen up over the years, but my basic thesis is that Australia needs to do more internationally than just dominate New Zealand, which is what we tend to do at the moment, particularly our financial sector dominates New Zealand. Now, if you compare that with multinationals in Australia, I've been able to list 270 of them who are doing revenues of more than $200 million a year in the Australian market. So basically, it's a almost 4-to-1 ratio when you look at the multinational numbers of 200 million here versus the Australian-based numbers of 200 million offshore. Biggest sectors where multinationals dominate, where Australian companies are absent, a pharma, fast-moving consumer goods in particular, where we've only really got Goodman Fielder and Foster's, or to a lesser degree Billabong, if you consider that fast-moving consumer goods. IT, Australia's just woeful in IT. Autos, financials. And probably my biggest criticism is resources, where we should be in the middle of a massive boom in Australia, yet we've got a $70 billion current account deficit in the middle of our best current account, or our best terms of trade figures in 50 years. And part of that is because basically 80% of all our resource projects are in the hands of multinationals. There's a list of all the multinationals that are doing more than $10 billion, that own more than $10 billion of assets in Australia. Rio is well up north of $100 billion. Many of them you never hear of, but same argument about how multinationals stay below the radar. You know, few people understand or know that Mitsubishi owns 50% of all of BHP's huge central Queensland coal mines, including the North West Shelf exposure. It would be worth $40, $50 billion, never even mentioned in the press at all. And as I said, rather in a populist manner to Adam Spencer on the radio this morning, Australia is probably the only modern Western democracy where two foreign governments own more Australian assets than the Australian government, and that is the Singaporeans and the Chinese, who together have somewhere between $30 and $50 billion invested in Australia, which is easily in excess of the value of the government's residual 17% in Telstra, Aussie Post, and just the Australian Submarine Corp and a couple of other little things that they still retain. And I simply say, you know, it's great we flogged the Poms at the Ashes and these things, but look at the Brits. They've got, you know, GlaxoSmithKline, likes of BP, Vodafone, all capped at more than $200 billion. And they've got all the fast-moving consumer goods, the pharma companies, and not many IT. But wouldn't it be great if Australia had the Shells or the BPs? You know, we really do ought to have an oil and gas major. Instead, we've got the best we've got is probably Woodside, which BHP sold its 40% stake in 1991 to at $3 a share, leaving about $20 billion on the table. If you look at the Woodside share price today, so. My thesis is that, particularly in the resources space, the Australian management, the Australian boards have mismanaged the resource. They've just basically made poor capital allocation decisions. You look how BHP wrote off $10 billion throughout the 1990s, when it was still sort of run as a combination of the Newcastle Workers Club and the Melbourne Club. And then they finally saw the light and brought in Paul Anderson as an international CEO to clean it up, and they've had a succession of international CEOs since then, haven't trusted another Australian to run the joint, and you can't blame them, given what they did. So why have Australian companies underperformed? I think there's an unhealthy, in terms of great success stories in Australia, it's an inwardly focused on services, resources and property. If you look at the top 200, too many of them are in those spaces. It's a great investment is buying a big bank share, shares in the last 15 years. You know, people forget that we've got the world's most expensive banking system. It's a locally focused oligopoly. None of our big banks have cut the lunch in Asia, particularly, or globally. They're all capped at 50, 60 billion, but they're just, you know, milking 25% a year, running a domestic cartel. They haven't done the national champion thing where they've scaled up and then gone international and created a genuinely international Australian brand. Obviously, the two big exceptions in the financial space are Macquarie and QBE. I guess we've got to go to the beach culture, I think. I mean, we do work very hard. The OECD figures show we work very hard, but I think we're too focused on leisure and sport. And a good example of that anecdotally in Melbourne is that the Herald Sun is the world's biggest selling newspaper in terms of penetration into its community, 540,000 into a community of 4 million. No other paper in the world does that, and its biggest thing is sport. So we all, you know, Melbourne's the sports capital of the world. We host the Olympics. Of course, we want the World Cup soccer, Commonwealth Games. We're all obsessed about sport and leisure. Australia's the world's biggest gamblers per capita. That's a leisure. Well, I don't know how poker machines is a leisure, but that's a leisure activity, reflects the culture of Australia. And from my space, it's the lack of culture of shareholder pressure, I think, is a huge factor. Rupert Murdoch had one question in 7 years in the 1990s in Adelaide. World's most powerful bloke. One question in 7 years from his shareholders until I came along, and I've had 10 cracks in a row at him. And we have a great half an hour debate every time, and it's a good debate, and that's what should happen all the time. But the institutions don't speak out enough, and the retail shareholder base is not particularly energised. I think our corporate power is way too concentrated. If you look at our banking sector, you look at the power of Telstra, the power of Qantas, our incumbent local players traditionally are incredibly huge in their market share and use their market power to stifle competitors. I mean, Virgin Blue's on the slide at the moment. How many competitors of Qantas have to go broke before people start asking questions about the competition implications of having such a dominant airline? Westfield, in terms of market share, no other supermarket chain in the world can be so dominant in one market. And even our free-to-air oligopoly. I was at the Austar shareholders meeting in Sydney last week, and the CEO of Austar said, Australia's free-to-air industry is the most protected industry in the world. It's just been politicians looking after the likes of the Packers and Kerry Stokes, stifling the innovation of pay TV. We were so far behind with pay TV, we're so far behind in broadband. A lot of that goes to protection of incumbent monopolists or license holders in free-to-air and telcos. And when you don't have a political class that actually believe in the consumer and technology and competition, but instead is too captured by the vested interests, who are the champions in Australian business, the incumbent players, it holds back the nation. And broadband for mine is one of the classic examples of that. I think we also lose too much of our talent offshore, which is partly a good thing, and I'll show you another slide in a tick. We need to cut the top tax rate to get all of our, particularly our males who leave and never come back. Underinvestment in skills and education and excessive union power. People keep saying unions are dying. Australia has the world's most powerful and cashed up union movement. The combined assets of all the Labor Party branches across the country and their affiliated unions is more than $1 billion. They have more than $1 billion of net assets between them. They control, you know, a lot of the industry funds and the superannuation, and we've got wall-to-wall Labor governments, and 70% of the Rudd cabinet are ex-union officials. I mean, don't tell me unions are dying in Australia. Unions, someone just took them on in John Howard, and they spent $30 million and knocked him off. And now a lot of it's being wound back. So I think just the history of Australia and union power is a part of the story of why we haven't been able to do well as well corporately as we should. And the second point up there about not exploiting the Asian opportunities. I mean, can you think of a single Australian scandal where we've been doing, an Australian company's been doing sweatshop labour in Asia? No, can't remember a single story on it. It's all Nike and, you know, everyone else. Now, I'm not saying we should be doing sweatshop practices in Asia, but I'm just making the point that there aren't even the Australian entrepreneurs who've gone out in a high-profile way, taken advantage of the cost benefits in Asia and built Australian-owned brand on lower labour costs in Australia. And that partly goes back to that union power and the scare campaigns that unions can run when companies do, as they sometimes have to, move plant and production offshore to cheaper locales. Now, here's a couple of slides just pointing out that whilst Australians, we don't produce enough internationally known brands, we produce more international CEOs than any other comparable country in the world. And there's a list of Australians who formerly ran, you know, McDonald's, Philip Morris, Coke, British Airways, Rentokil, Ford, Scottish and Newcastle. That's a pretty amazing list, and that's just the former group. Look at the next slide, you've got the Aussies now at or near the top. There's an Australian CEO of Dow Chemical, Kellogg's. Philip Bowman used to run Scottish Power and Allied Domecq, so two big British brands. He's now running Smiths. The 2IC at DuPont. The joint CEO of DHL has just joined the Telstra board, which is a good thing. John Mullen, to get the talent coming back into Australia and serving on Australian boards. And the heir apparent at Morgan Stanley, James Gorman, a Melbourne boy who rose up through Merrill Lynch here, is tipped to be the next CEO at Morgan Stanley. So we have a great record. Australians, they travel, they're easy to get on with, they're entrepreneurial, they travel internationally, they rise to the top of international companies, yet for some reason we can't seem to produce these international companies ourselves. And the challenge is also to get this talent that we do leave to come back to Australia and serve on Australian boards and you know, bring their businesses back here. Now, the contradiction to this point is that Australia also has more expats running our biggest 10 companies than any other country in the world. So at the moment, 8 of our top 10 companies are run by expat CEOs. So it's this whole BHP cultural cringe, we can't trust the locals to run our biggest companies. And there you have it. Marius Kloppers is the fourth straight expat at BHP, Sol Trujillo, John Stewart. Admittedly, Gail Kelly came from South Africa quite a long time ago, and Ralph Norris is a Kiwi, so we can call him an honorary Australian. But of the biggest, of the top 12, you know, Westfield, Frank Lowy, the founder, Woolies, just the local service sector market dominant sort of play, nothing to be particularly proud of for Australia. Fortescue, great story, missed totally by the Australian institutions, and QBE, one of the truly great stories, genuinely making 80% of its profits offshore and run by Frank O'Halloran, who's been finance director or CEO since 1978. So a true star, Frank O'Halloran. Then you've got the fact that this trend of expat CEOs running our biggest companies doesn't go particularly deep. I can only come up with another 8 in our top 100. So Lendlease had its troubles, went for Greg Clark from the UK. Amcor fired the cartel man Russell Jones, gave the job to a Canadian. David Knox at Santos, the new guy. David Kirk, again, sort of an honorary Aussie, the All Blacks captain. And you can see the others listed there. Andy Penn from the UK running AXA Asia Pacific. But only 16 of the top 100 expats, but 8 of the top 10. So it's very much skewed right to the big cap end of the market in Australia. Just a couple of quick comments on Kevin Rudd and the agenda. People forget that his personal financial record is fantastic, absolutely fantastic. That in Queensland, he became the opposition leader back in the late 1980s. Queensland Labor Party sold their radio station for $16 million. Rather than spending that money in knocking off a long-term National Party government of Sir Joh, he kept that money, they knocked off Sir Joh, and the Queensland Labor Party now has $150 million in its investment fund. So Rudd, as the Chief of Staff to the Premier, and then as the head of the Cabinet and the key bureaucrat in Queensland, got them into office and kept them in office, and at the same time the Labor Party built up the biggest political war chest in the country. Then you've got Queensland's finances, lowest taxes in the country, only state with fully funded super, clearly the strongest balance sheet. That's partly Rudd's legacy in Queensland. And then you have the personal financial record is when he was left Goss's office, and before he got onto the front bench, he and his wife set up this business, and they're now worth $60 million. So he's actually a smart guy with his own finances in his family. So I say from that that it's pretty optimistic for Australia that the guy actually is pretty economically conservative and sensible at his party, government and personal level. So Australia should be in good hands. The other point to that is the first budget, I think, was a massive missed opportunity, because like any new CEO who comes into a job, you always want to paint the last guy black. And you always want to, I'm always complaining about CEOs who do ridiculous write-offs that can't be justified just to say the last guy was a dill. And, political parties do that as well, but their whole strategy was inflation. Howard let inflation out of the genie out of the bottle. Whereas instead, they should have said that Howard and Rudd have massively mismanaged, that Howard and Costello were irresponsible, that they shouldn't have taken $23 billion of dividends out of the Reserve Bank over 12 years, that they shouldn't have left the Reserve Bank with only $27 billion of foreign reserves, 37th in the world and way behind countries like Mexico, the Philippines, Thailand, Poland, you name it, all these countries that we should be way ahead. Now, the Koreans ran out of foreign reserves on Christmas Day in 1998. They've now got $280 billion, the Koreans. And here's Australia, sort of arrogant, complacent. We're on the middle of a commodities boom, and the Howard government just gives these massive tax cuts, becomes a real tax and spend government, doesn't build up the foreign reserves war chest. And Rudd could have come in and said, from now on, we're going to have a properly capitalised Reserve Bank. We're going to put $5 billion in there. We're going to fully fund super, like I did in Queensland. And he could have come out with a budget surplus figure of $5 billion. He could have said the real figure is actually only $5 billion, and then he could have been able to withstand the pensioners and the carers and everyone who's coming at him now saying you've made $22 billion, give it back, give it back. And he didn't take the opportunity, and I think he's going to regret that, because now the perception is, and he did little rorts in his budget, like he took an extra billion out of the Reserve Bank. So rather than actually stopping the raise in the Reserve Bank, he took an extra billion to get his figure up even higher. So the rhetoric was, I'm going to be tough. And then they weren't actually tough, and they actually did some accounting fiddles to come up with a bigger figure, and now they've got the vested interest groups coming at them, and I think they're going to regret that. I think that business in Australia haven't quite yet realised what the Howard years were like. The fact that the bank cartel was able to go from a cap of $70 billion to a cap of $250 billion with the government saying nothing. Eddie Groves, ABC Learning, was able to become the world's biggest childcare company and the most subsidised company in Australia, and put its prices up and no one said anything. And, Larry Anthony, the former children's minister, joins the board of ABC Learning 6 months after leaving Parliament. That's all over. And I don't think that business has quite cottoned on yet. And the whole Few Watch thing is an illustration of that. And Rudd using phrases like, we're not on the side of big oil. And Gillard using phrases like, we're going to take whatever measures are necessary to keep childcare costs down. Swan warning the banks about interest rate rises. The Labor Party in Queensland slapping on this extra coal royalty because what is Queensland Labor care? It's all multinationals making out with huge profits in Queensland. Rudd slapping on that $550 million a year tax on the North West Shelf. Again, only 10% Australian owned. So I think what we're going to see, and particularly in Victoria where Brumby refused to compensate the two pokies licensees, Tattersalls and Tabcorp, when they were both expecting $600 million and it was written into legislation, that you are going to see a little bit of a rise in sovereign risk in Australia, royalty deals that are broken. Don't be surprised at all if the iron ore royalty in WA doesn't jack up from 3.75% to something closer to 5 or 6% above a certain level, which is the model that the Queensland Labor Party did. People forget the Labor states are borrowing $20 billion a year net at the top of a boom. I mean, they are heading for credit rating downgrades. They are desperate for revenue. And if the feds don't bail them out with their surplus, you're going to see downgrades in the states because Australia has a weird system of the most powerful second tier of government in the world. There's no other country in the world where the states do so much and no revenue. So that's why we're the world's biggest gamblers, because it's the states, one of the few options they've got to raise money. So they desperately do it. So I think that this whole dynamic of federalism is going to be probably the most important thing to see out of Rudd. And I think it's actually the most, apart from his personal financial record, I actually think that it's the biggest upside we'll get from Rudd is that in Queensland, and I was working with Kennett at the time, Queensland was driving a lot of the COAG competition reform agenda back in the early 90s when Rudd was there. He's a big believer in federal state reform. Wall-to-wall Labor, there is a unique opportunity to actually get some serious regulatory reforms. They're doing the no-brainers like margin lending and credit and these issues to become federal. And I think there are big dividends that will flow from that. So I'm actually quite optimistic about that. Now, I'm probably running out of time, so I'm just going to skip along to this whole question about, I can make a point that Australia doesn't have a consumer culture. There's not a single politician in the country I'm aware of who actually is known for standing up for consumers. We've got the Party for Labor, organised labour in the unions, and the Party for Big Business. So I think that it's an unfortunate feature of Australia that our consumer movement is so weak, just like our shareholder movement is so weak, that whole go to the beach culture. Corporate social responsibility in Australia, nowhere near as big as in the UK, which is leading the world. I think the guns, pulp mill issue is interesting, that the Wilderness Society ran a campaign against the ANZ, a single institution, and now you're seeing GetUp, pretty effective organisation, basically sending out warnings to any other financier, don't fund the guns, pulp mill. I personally can't see Woolworths sustaining a situation of being Australia's biggest poker machine company. 11,000 poker machines, causes enormous misery. I just don't see how, there should be a massive consumer boycott against Woolies. But you have this weird situation in Australia of the Labor Party. Kevin Rudd says he hates the pokies, so that's why I think there will be a bit of a backlash against Woolies on pokies if you've seen the things about Alka Pops, the position he's taken on binge drinking. But who would have thought the Labor Party actually runs 500 of their own poker machines in Canberra, in the Canberra Labor Clubs, the only political party that I'm aware of in the world that actually runs gambling dens for revenue raising. So, who would have thought? I won't bore you with a summary of the current collapses. It'll take me about 3 hours. But Australia, I think in summary, has gone through a repeat of sort of the late 1980s where there was a major corporate governance failure. It's not as bad as what the sort of things that Bond was getting up to, but I think all these collapses we've just seen, there needs to be a pretty strong regulatory reaction to that. I track the numbers of people that ASIC sends to jail, our corporate clod. I only sent 17 last year, which was their second lowest in 10 years. And again, I think that's the legacy of the Howard years, the sort of the lax on regulation. I will think you will see a bit of a backlash because of all these collapses, poor disclosure, and you will see some tougher regulations coming out of Canberra as a result of that. There's a few points about AGM reforms, which is not really in your space. Now, this is the key point I want to leave you with today. But in terms of who runs Australia, my thesis is basically that Australian corporates have not been served well by their CEOs and by their boards. And the system is working better now with CEOs. Dud CEOs are getting shoved out the door more rapidly these days than they used to in the old days, where you would have you know, BHP hanging on to John Prescott for 7 years. You'd have WMC hanging on to Hugh Morgan for more than a decade. People not getting shifted on when they should. But the same can't be said for the directors. That Australian directors, non-executive directors, still very difficult to remove them, still hang around for too long if they perform badly. So my first slide for you on this point is, where do our top chairs come from? Where do they come from? And the largest category easily is CEOs of big companies. So Don Argus ran NAB, then went chairman of BHP and Brambles. Michael Chaney ran Wesfarmers, chairs Woodside and NAB. Lee Clifford, straight from Rio to the Qantas chair. Don Mercer, sacked as ANZ CEO, still managed to come back to be chair of Orica and Newcrest, and the list goes on. Get the occasional example of a CEO damaging their reputation, leaving with a stellar reputation, a la Stan Wallace at Amcor, and finishing up not even being able to take his retirement money from AMP, which is what happened to poor old Stan. So that's where they come from at the moment. And my thesis is that the gene pool is too narrow, it's not deep enough. We need more directors, we need more turnover directors, we need to look to new sectors. Now, in terms of the most powerful non-CEOs in the directors club, so where do they come from? Lawyers, accountants, so David Donsky is a lawyer, banker, Rick Allett, an accountant, Peter Mansell, a lawyer, John Storey, a lawyer. So these players who are the accounting partners who deal with these corporates, these major listed companies, they are the auditors, they are the accountants, they get to know them, and that's when the directors club kicks in, where we know you, we've dealt with you for a while, you're on the network, on the circuit, you can rise and eventually join the club and eventually ascend to the chair of some of our biggest and best our best companies. Now, this is the most successful regional CEOs, so your group, who've got onto ASX boards. So Dick Warburton is the most successful. He was the DuPont CEO who went on to chair DJs. He's the current chairman of Caltex. He was on the board of Tabcorp, New Farm, and about half a dozen other boards. Now, he told me that his big breakthrough came when he was on the Manufacturing Council in South Australia, and the Labor government in the Hawke or Keating Labor government in the early 90s was looking for someone from South Australia to represent manufacturing, and through the Manufacturing Council connections, he got a call, do you want to join the Reserve Bank? And then he rang his American boss and said, I've just been offered a position on the Reserve Bank board. And he said, is that like the Federal Reserve? And he was so proud of the fact that his regional CEO was being offered the equivalent of the Federal Reserve, that he changed policy and let him take the position. So the first challenge is actually to be allowed to take a board seat by your head office. And that was how Dick Warburton broke through. Once he was on the Reserve Bank, he was away. And he's now become our most prolific director. Bob Savage, pretty high profile CEO of IBM, very visible in the media and the networks, Business Council, etc. Now chairman of Perpetual and David Jones. Peter Coates, great job running Xstrata Coal, has just joined Santos. Brian Healy, chairman of Centro, very unfortunate, shouldn't still be there, but hasn't resigned yet, even though Centro is an implosion. He was the CEO of Nicholas Kiwi. And after that, you know, Mark Smith, ex-Cadbury's I think now, joined Toll, Frank Swan from Cadbury to Foster's, again because Australia has so few fast-moving consumer goods companies.
Should add Ziggy Switkowski.
And Ziggy Switkowski, of course, actually he's the best one. He's probably the second best one after Dick. So, and Ziggy I think got his start with Amcor and then, So, that's my last slide. So my basic message is that I think that many of you, if you are planning on staying in Australia, and that's obviously a big question, there's two things I'd say that you do. One is that you talk to your head office about the policy on taking one board seat, and I've got one other slide I didn't put up here, which is a list of the current Australian CEOs who have one other board seat, and that's Jeff Dixon at Qantas is on Packer's media board, Wal King, the latent CEO, is on Coke, the Australian Coke. John Stewart, the NAB CEO, has just joined Telstra. So at the very top, it's actually quite common. I heard Sir Rod Eddington give a speech the other week basically advocating this, that he was a much better CEO of BA because he sat on the News Corp board and had the perspective of that. So I think make the argument that it's good to sit on one public company board, and then think about a career which is jumping off your current position and going to become a full-time non-executive director. So picking up three or four board seats like Bill Cutbush did. He was Bell and Howe's guy in Australia, and he sat on the board of Coates, Blackmore, Freedom, Miller's Retail. So, you know, not top 100 companies, but he's carved out a career as a professional non-executive director, because we need more quality people running, sitting as NEDs on our big company boards. It's particularly poor in that 100 company down level, and you're such a huge part of our economy, and you're not tapped into by the existing networks which are run, which is the way the system works to produce directors at the moment. So I'd recommend you do the RACD course, have your name down with headhunters, and attempt to do that. And I'm going to be making this argument myself at AGMs and elsewhere, because in terms of that, the foreign ownership, the performance of Australia, I really do think Australia as a nation has suffered immeasurably from the poor performance and the poor quality of our top boards. And you have to think constructively about how you can actually turn that around. I think you guys are part of the answer. So thanks for listening, and happy to take some questions.
Very wise message to finish.
Yeah.
I think everyone around the room will quite enjoy it. Yeah. We've got around 15 or 20 minutes with Stephen. So James, actually.
Stephen, you lament Australia not having any of its own indigenous resource companies. The country from China north has suddenly began its acquisition this year, clearly where it's been ahead in the resource sector here. When do you think you see it happen? How do you think the Russian government will respond?
Well, I think that is the biggest question in Australia, in Australian business, sort of business political scene today. There's more than 10 Chinese government proposals sitting before the FIRB at the moment, which they're just sitting on, saying we're still working out what our policy is. The Chinese want to be like the Japanese, who have over $100 billion worth of equity value in Australian resource projects. If you add up all the, I mean, they're big joint venture players in many coal, iron ore, and they've got 16% of the Northwest Shelf. And we all know the position between the Japanese and the Chinese, and the Chinese would like to have a similar equity position in their major resource supplier. Rudd obviously is perceived, I heard Andrew Robb in the Parliament give a speech yesterday saying that he's perceived in the region to be pro-China, went to China first, etc. And I think Rudd is, and he was calling for Rudd to overcompensate for that perception. And I think there is a chance that Rudd might overcompensate and actually block, maybe block a couple of super sensitive ones if they came through. But I think it's inevitable, it's coming. They're coming at like one or two a week in terms of, you know, even the minor iron ore plays. And a lot of Australians are making a lot of money. It's holding up our share market, just that whole perception. I mean, Twiggy Forrest is worth $12 billion. He's double James Packer. And the China story as both a supplier and a potential equity buyer is driving that. So I think it's a huge issue. And I think that it's interesting that Australia doesn't have that many Dick Smiths. And I sort of skirt around the edges of saying it. I mean, I'm not anti-foreign investment, but I just wish that Australia, you know, I want an open market, but I just wish Australian companies had done better. So I'm not advocating that we block. But in terms of Chinese government investments, my position is that we should be allowed to invest into China on the same terms that China can invest into Australia. And the government should leverage that negotiating position to open up access to particularly portfolio super investment into China, rather than just having an open door, completely open door approach.
Richard.
Stephen, to what extent do you agree that actually shareholders of listed companies in Australia have done really well?
Yeah, I think the consumer has certainly done a lot worse than the shareholder. And the best example of that is the stock exchange itself. I mean, the ASX is Australia's most lucrative monopoly. The 606 stockbroker members who demutualised that have turned 25,000 into 5 million. And all the customers of the ASX have been getting ripped off blind for years. And that just sums up Australia. The farmers find the vast majority of their value scooped up by the supermarket majors. So I think the farmers have had a pretty unfortunate time, those that are not exporting but directly supplying our supermarket majors. Sometimes you can defend it. I think Australian television consumers have a good product, even though it's pretty outrageous the way the industry structure has worked. But I think it's in the sectors where there is that domestic service sector oligopoly. So in those sectors, yes, if you're in big supermarkets or big banks, of course shareholders have won massively. And if you're in resources, you've done brilliantly as well. So, yeah, it's been a good ride for shareholders. All those floats, you know, the shareholders in Transurban have made 700%. The shareholders in Tabcorp have made, 1,000%. The shareholders of CSL who bought in off the government have made, 50-fold. So, yeah, I think Australia is a great shareholding democracy. We have a very high level of ownership. We have the fourth biggest pool of super in the world at 1.2 billion. I sort of lament the fact that that 1.2 trillion can't get set in more of our resource projects because so few of it is listed and available. And that's why I go to the Rio Tinto AGM each year and say, get out of London and get down here. You should be listed here with your $100 billion of assets here and not sitting in London with four knights and two lords on your board and not a single mining project in the UK and only two Australians out of 15 and only 15% Australian ownership. I mean, I just think those sort of things are silly. But Rio Tinto shareholders have done very well.
Stephen, do you see any disconnect between your comments about the fact that Australia needs more national champions, therefore the ACCC perhaps should be a little bit more lenient and enable them to grow in scale, and your comments about how oligopolistic, I have trouble with that word all the time, Australia is in there and the damage that it does in terms of competition in the market?
Well, I think the banking sector is the best example of that. I mean, they keep on running this national champion argument, and I simply say, the four of you at the peak last November were worth $275 billion, average of $65 billion. How big do you have to get before you can expand overseas? I mean, you're not bulking up from $1 billion to $10 billion. You're already making $25 billion a year from delivering the world's most expensive banking service to all your suffering consumers, big and small. Why don't you go off internationally and do it now? I mean, Woolworths, okay, they're going to be the king of New Zealand, but they're hardly Walmart, you know, kicking butt in the UK and Mexico and this sort of stuff. So I simply say, show me a merger where you need to get big to go international, and if you can make the case and then you go and do it, I'll back it. Yeah. But don't just become a cartel and stay local and then and argue you need to go from being worth $60 billion to $120. Can't see the argument.
Christine.
Oh, it should stay. I mean, people forget that we have the most concentrated financial services sector in the world to the extent that our big four banks also have a majority in funds management. So you have this weird situation with the US, you've got Fidelity is the biggest mutual fund, and Citibank is the biggest bank. One runs the equity side, one runs the debt side. Here, we have these huge conglomerates where the Commonwealth Bank is both the biggest equity investor and the biggest debt lender, when equity and debt are fundamentally conflicted. So I think that you shouldn't have big banks dominating funds management. And the Centro collapse was the classic case. Commonwealth Bank funds management arm drops $500 million because the Commonwealth Bank debt arm contributed to sending it under. And that's the sort of concentration that I think is unhealthy. So I definitely would support retention of four pillars, and I'd encourage demerging of the bank funds management operations as well.
We had Bob Savage interviewed in a recent magazine. He was saying one of the concerns that he has is the disparity that's growing between executive pay and NED pays. What are your views on that?
I made that exact point at Babcock and Brown's AGM last Friday. All the top executives are on 5, 10, 15 million, and the poor old Neds are struggling along on 170 a year. And I think that it's ridiculous that you have a situation of, say, Peter Mansell, who's, chairman of Zinifex and Oxiana and three other public companies and two other boards, he sits on eight boards, can't possibly do his job, but he has to sit on that many to make the million bucks a year he was making as the managing partner of Freehills. So I think a regular Ned should be on 250 to three, should sit on four boards absolute max, but ideally, one chair at 700 and two others at 300, and, full-time and making 1.3, 1.4 a year. So I definitely agree that to get the talent, we need to pay our NEDs more, and it's ridiculous that CEO pay has gone through the roof, and NEDs are struggling along with barely CPI.
Yes.
Well, I see. I own the world's biggest share portfolio of 700 stocks, not even worth 175 grand. So I have an average holding of 300 in every stock, and IAG is the one I can't hold because my wife's on the board of the RACV, which has a $3 billion joint venture with IAG. So I've actually met sort of Mike Hawker at RACV functions and things. But I think objectively, you know, not to be repeated to Mike, he had to go. And I think also that James Strong, after 7 years as the chairman, should be under pressure. And I actually hit James Strong with a question at the Woolworths AGM last year where I said, you put yourself forward to be chairman of Qantas after the private equity bid fell over. Which board were you planning to step down from as chairman, IAG or Woolworths? And he sort of deflected it and said, oh, I never put myself forward and all this sort of stuff. But I think he was planning to flick IAG. And Strong's too busy. He's got two big chairs, plus Qantas, plus Rip Curl. And I think IAG's performed badly, and he stuck with his CEO for too long when there was underperformance. So, and most occasions, CEOs and chairs tend to go together. There's a lot of examples where within a year, and whenever a company gets in strife, whether it's Lendlease, BHP, Westpac, ANZ, over the years, I've measured this, very often that they leave together. So I think AMP, I think that you'll see Strong out within 6 or 9 months, and should be.
Time for a couple more questions. I've got a question, Stephen, about you talked about Bondi the other day at the Babcock and Brown AGM. I'm wondering what role you're going to play in his future. And just a more general question, what drives you to be a sort of a professional gadfly and irritant in the corporate sector in Australia?
Well, I guess just quickly on Bondi, that I was absolutely shocked to see him back on the rich list. I mean, if you read Paul Barry's books, he's just an out-and-out crook. He, you know, when he was in bankruptcy trouble, he hired Jim Burns, a well-known sort of murderer and heroin dealer who'd done time, to be sort of negotiator. And he got rich dealing with dictators like Pinochet in Chile, and now he's just back dealing with the African dictators, paying the appropriate bribes to get access to the resources. I mean, it's just a disgrace to Australia. And I got up at the Babcock AGM and said, there was a bloke in New York on the big screen who's a Babcock director called Joe Raby, and he's chairman emeritus of Credit Suisse. And Credit Suisse had lent $85 million to Bondi's Madagascar oil. So I got up and gave him a blast, and I got shut down summarily by the chairman for asking an irrelevant question. But that's the whole, it's like what GetUp is doing with ANZ, is this whole notion of sort of, if something is bad, whether you argue a pulp miller's bag or whether you argue animal testing in the UK, which has been the most celebrated example of global financial campaigns, that there is, in this globalised world, there are more global campaigns. So GetUp is sending a message to all international banks, don't fund the pulp mill or there'll be some sort of consumer boycott against you. And I do think that, particularly in the UK, where this is strongest, that companies need to think about that. And that's what I was trying to do to the Credit Suisse guy, just trying to put him under pressure in a public forum for banking Bondi. And he got that message, and I think that's quite an interesting trend in the way that activism is going. And
do you think we're in the very early days of sort of PETA campaigns, etc., in Australia?
Yeah, I think Australia, again, it's that go to the beach thing. I mean, the things that people fire up about in Australia are work rights, because the unions are so powerful. Green groups are effective in Australia. But after that, you know, there's not that many active groups, and consumers and shareholders are two examples. And those consumer boycott-style campaigns, or the lack of them in Australia, is an example of hopefully a growing area. Hopefully GetUp can step into that. And what drives me? I was a journalist who got sick of going to AGMs and seeing hopeless debate. You know, turn up at BHP and no questions, just lost $1 billion on something. And so my position, basically, I saw a massive gap, saw that no one was doing it, and I saw an opportunity that, you know, Rupert Murdoch, Kerry Packer won't talk to you 364 days a year, won't take your call, will tell you to get stuffed if you stop them on the street. But at the AGM, the law says that you have to be given a reasonable right to comment on the management and general operations or any other issues. No one's going to beat you up. You know, you're not at the footy getting beaten up by a Collingwood fan for speaking out. That's all very polite and civilised. And I thought there was value to add. I really do passionately believe that that corporates will do better over time if there is a culture of shareholder pressure, a culture of accountability and transparency. So I thought there's a public good in that, and I was also trying to survive as an independent publisher as well, and saw that as a leg of that. But I, my eventual plan is to probably try and set up an activist fund. I'm going to run for the ASX board this year on a platform of improving governance, not giving the Macquaries and the Babcocks all these exemptions to list their funds in Bermuda and have directors for life and not disclose management agreements and all these sort of governance low road things that the ASX has waved through. So I'm going to run for the ASX board on a platform of far stronger governance, and then eventually next year hopefully set up some sort of activist fund, because I've found, you can turn up and speak out and they can ignore you. You can then run for their board and they have to treat you a bit more seriously, but they can still ignore you. And if they keep ignoring you, then you actually have to be able to buy a position and then articulate the case from a position of being a shareholder with 1% or 2%. And that's where I think the fund, and once again, all these activist hedge funds all over the world, and the closest thing to an activist investor in Australia is, Sir Ron Brearley, aged, 74, playing around in the small caps. So out of a London listed company. So the idea of having an Australian-based, Australian-run activist fund, annoying companies, taking them on, taking positions, arguing for better governance, I think, again, would be healthy for the market.
All right. One final question.
What would you do if you get on one of these
boards? That won't happen. Yeah, often I say that I would resign based on a change happening. So if I run on a platform, then once they've implemented or made the change that the shareholders have backed, then I would leave. Because, Stan Wallace said to me when I first ran for the AMP board, he said, your business model is stuffed if you ever get elected. Because you won't be able to, speak out about things. And I am quite limited with the whole RACV thing. I've said a few things about IAG today. But, yeah, so I think I would be conflicted. So I'd have to get off.
We've run out of time. It just remains for me to thank Stephen. Fascinating area. Clearly an important role. You play an important role in keeping boards on their toes in Australia. And you found finally something you're very, very good at after all those failed NED campaigns and political campaigns. We've covered an enormous amount of ground today, and I know we've sort of gone on longer, so we look forward to having you back at some stage to talk about another report card on the state of corporate Australia. But it's been a very informative session. I think we get a sense of the enormous energy that you have, Stephen, which I think at the end of the day is a very good positive for the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you.